And now, live from England, bringing you news and analysis that you won't find on the corporate and government mainstream media. It's the Wide Shut Webcast.
Good evening, everyone. You are tuned in to another episode of the Wide Shut Webcast on FTP Radio. That's flipping thepyramid.co.uk and my own website with articles and free to watch documentaries and so on is wideshut.co.uk. And as always, I'm your host, Keelan Balderson. Lots of good feedback regarding last week's episode on the Holly Greig hoax. I think people are finally starting to understand. Waking up isn't about stopping blindly believing in the mainstream media only to blindly believe in alternative media. It's about critical thinking. It's about critiquing all forms of media and all sources of information. It's about becoming your own media, become your own trusted source of information. What better way to get the truth of a topic than to research it and come to your own conclusion? And that's what tonight's guest has done in regard to the 7/7 London bombings. It's what I've tried to do with the 7/7 London bombings. You know, I've read all the official accounts and reports about what allegedly happened that day on those trains and on that bus. I've gone through inquest transcripts. I've read countless media reports and have come to the conclusion that the government and police don't know what happened that day. And the MI5 have done their best to stop people from critically looking at all the evidence to come to a conclusion about what happened that day. I've also looked at alternative theories and come to the conclusion that they too fall short of the evidence and don't really know exactly what happened that day. And we've got Tom Secker coming up in a few short minutes to discuss all things 7/7, including the BBC's appalling 7/7 conspiracy road trip show. But before we get to that, if you're new to the Wide Shut webcast, the show first airs at 8 p.m. UK time at flippingthepyramid.co.uk, and then shortly after that first airing on the Sunday, links are posted on wideshut.co.uk, where you can get an MP3 file. We're on iTunes. We're also on YouTube and the Stitcher mobile application. Now, as many of you regular listeners will know, as well as doing articles for wideshut.co.uk, covering as much of the news that I can, and as well as this weekly show, I also produce independent documentaries covering subjects and angles to stories that the mainstream media simply don't touch, whether that's through ignorance, through corporate agenda or government agenda. The stuff I tend to cover, they tend to not cover. And I've got two primary films out at the moment. That's 7/7, What Did They Know? Looking at all the intelligence the authorities had about the alleged 7/7 bombers before the attacks, how they surveilled them, what they knew about them, and also all the preparations before the bombings that were undertaken by the security and emergency services and the intelligence and warnings from other countries stating that attacks on the underground were highly likely. You know, this wasn't out of the blue. They made preparations specifically for these kinds of attacks, but for whatever reason, even though the bombers were right under their nose and even though they had prepared for these attacks, they couldn't prevent them. And then after the fact, a lot of the information has been held back and there's been a cover-up. And of course, I say bombers, and what I really mean is alleged bombers, because there's no actual solid proof that they carried out the attacks. and I've gone through that as well, as has my guest Tom Secker, who we'll be going to in a minute. I've also made the film Perfect Storm, The England Riot, looking at the Mark Duggan shooting case and putting the riots into a context in terms of austerity and the general downturn in society at the hands of the elite and this corrupt system that we all find ourselves in. And next week, actually, I do plan to be going over all the latest in the Mark Duggan case, because it seems the police are still lying to cover their own backs, and there is still a lot of injustice going on. I mean, if we can't get to the bottom of the spark that caused the riots and get justice in that incident, then how at all can we fairly assess the riots themselves? And I also have a third film in the works, which will be out sometime next year, and that's tentatively called Strange Bedfellows, Islamic Terrorists and the West, which is going to completely blow the myth of the war on terror out of the water. At virtually every stage of the fundamentalist, extremist, Muslim movement, our Western governments have supported and aided them. I know that doesn't make a lot of sense, but forget what you know about the war on terror. It's a lie. It's a microcosm within a much larger context. The CIA trained and armed the Afghan Mujahideen in the late 70s and through the 80s against the Soviets. They worked directly alongside Osama bin Laden, this boogeyman that they used a decade or so later to, say, attacked America on 9/11. The Taliban, who then took over after the Soviet-Afghan war in Afghanistan, received considerable aid from the US in the years before 9/11. There's a photo of Reagan, President Reagan, meeting with some of these extremist fundamentalist Muslims. Fast forward to 9/11, and some of the 9/11 hijackers, or alleged 9/11 hijackers, received their visas to come to the US through a CIA-run consulate in Saudi Arabia. The Bin Ladens have a long history of business dealings with the Bush family. And also in the 90s, Britain and America supported the extremist Islamist KLA in a dirty war against Milosevic in the Balkans. And at that same period, many veterans of the Soviet-Afghan era were given refuge in Britain and permitted, allowed, to preach jihad against the West and the rest of the world. The UK government allowed people like Omar Bakri and Abu Hamza to radicalise young Muslims in Britain and send them for terror training overseas to help in that dirty war in the Balkans against Milosevic. The MO continued. Recently, when NATO bombed the Libyans into liberation, you know, as if bombing brings peace, during that conflict, NATO supported Al-Qaeda-linked rebels in taking over Libya. In Syria, again, the West is backing the Islamic extremists against the Syrian regime. This is a long-standing, hand-in-glove relationship. You look at things like the underpants bomber, allowed onto the plane, directed onto the plane by the US government. At every turn throughout history, the West has supported and aided these people. And then in terrorist attacks, there's collusion between the intelligence agencies and the supposed terrorists we're fighting. And how can we be sending young men to fight in this war on terror in Afghanistan and across the world, when we're also supporting the very same types of people in proxy wars in Syria and Libya? It is very strange. That's why it's called Strange Bedfellows. The relationship does not make sense to the average person. But when you understand the agenda, it makes perfect sense. As always, your government's lying to you. They don't care about right or wrong, or good and evil, when it supports them and their power-hungry agenda and the agenda of the corporatists. They will support terrorists, or they'll fight the supposed terrorists. As long as it supports their agenda, it's fine. There's no morality here. And I'll be exposing all that in the film. And if you'd like to make a donation to support me in making this, and actually I think it'll end up really being a series of 1 hour programs rather than just one long film, focusing on each aspect of collusion and each aspect of this relationship. But if you want to support me in doing this, please go to wideshut.co.uk, and on the right hand side you can see the donation information page there. You'll get a DVD copy of the film, or as I say, now that I'm thinking about turning it into a series, you'll get at least one copy of the first few programs in the series. In other words, you'll get a disc with as many episodes as I can cram on one disc, basically. So you'll get a documentary length disc, but it might not be the full series. We'll have to look into that and come to some arrangements on how all that's going to go down. And of course, it's all going to be available on YouTube for free as well. I'm just looking for some token support to help me take time off my day job to focus on really trying to get this done. So please check out the project. Watch the early trailer that's up there. A trailer I made many months ago now, to give you a kind of taster of what it's going to be about. And if you support my work and have enjoyed my other films, please consider making a pledge. We're going to go to a quick break now, and when we come back, I'll be talking with Tom Secker about 7-7 Conspiracy Road Trip and lots of other aspects of the 7-7 case as well. Keep it locked here on the Wide Shut webcast with me, Keelan Balderson.
I think a new world order is emerging, and with it the foundations of
the Great Depression, and I will cry every day. As a result of Labour's economic management, your child will have debts among the biggest anywhere at any time in history.
I want to get straight to the point. I'm a second-rate substitute Tony Blair. Let me tell you why I want to be Prime Minister. It's because I want to live in a large, very warm house worth over £1 million. We will never change. We are still the arrogant, callous, ruthless, wicked Tories. And you know what? We won't help anyone. I will skip across the playground and give the money to the rich, and we'd have a new world order.
Wideshut.co.uk. If they won't tell you the truth, we will.
Flipping the pyramid.
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 Flip the pyramid.
Flipping the pyramid.
Flip the pyramid.
We aim to see the world as it really is.
Turning that pyramid on its head.
www.flippingthepyramid.co.uk.
Flipping the pyramid.
Flipping the pyramid.
Flippingthepyramid.co.uk.
Flipping the whole paradigm of that hierarchical system on its head.
We're going to go over to our guest now. Joining us on the line is once again Tom Secker. Tom is the producer of 7-7 Seeds of Deconstruction and 7-7 Crime and Prejudice. You can also get all of his analysis on the London bombings and terrorism in general at investigatingtheterror.com. There's also a good audio section on there with his various interviews on quite a vast array of topics now. All very interesting and definitely worth listening to. But welcome back to the show, Tom.
Hi, Keelan. It's good to be back.
So since the last time we talked, we've had the 7-7 Conspiracy Road Trip. That was a fun little show, wasn't it, Tom?
It was even worse than we expected it to be. I mean, I think we anticipated this was going to be a relatively poor piece of television. But they really scraped the bottom of the barrel with this one.
Yeah. Tom, of course, like me, was asked to go on the show. And I want to hear your experience of that, because Renegade Pictures, the production company, flagrantly lied to me. For those that haven't seen the article on wideshut.co.uk, I've included some of the emails I had with somebody called Oliver Page from Renegade. But basically, my angle to them was I brought up the issues with the original 9/11 episode, mainly just the concept itself, this conspiracy theorists versus official story theme that the BBC always seems to go with, which really doesn't help anyone, it doesn't inform anyone or get to the bottom of these kinds of events. It just puts people at polar opposites, and it tends, I think, to turn the general public away from actually looking into anything. Nobody wants to be a silly conspiracy theorist, do they? So I suggested to Renegade that they tackle 7/7 in a more hardline approach rather than this condescending bus trip. And Oliver Page assured me that he'd be dealing with it in a quite a different manner than the 9/11 one. And I'll just read out this email to everyone. He said, "I think most importantly, Andrew Maxwell's role needs to be clarified. His starting point for this episode is not one of a presenter trying to convince people that the official account is true, quite the opposite. As an Irishman, he is only too aware of the state's involvement in Omar, the Finucane case, and more. His start point is that he knows what they have done in the past, and what they are capable of, and wants to investigate their potential involvement in 7/7, while addressing the gaps in evidence and information. As you note, we are also trying to distance ourselves from deconstructive labels such as conspiracy theorists." I mean, you can't get more of a bold-faced lie than that. And what kind of things were they selling to you, Tom?
Well, actually, I got an email from Oliver Page, that was almost word-for-word identical to that one.
Okay.
At one point, because I was trying to sort of deal with these people. I was trying to be reasonable with them. I never actually sort of specifically refused to be involved in the show. I just said that I had certain conditions for my involvement, and that if those, you know, weren't met, then I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But yeah, like you, I sort of pursued this argument saying, look, if you want to discuss this issue, then you've got to discuss it properly and seriously. And if you want to actually look at these reasons why there has been private investigations, citizens' investigations, the July 7th Truth Campaign, all of this, if you want to know why all that's actually going on, then you have to take the subject seriously. And yeah, I got a response pretty much like that one, saying, oh yeah, yeah, we know about Ireland, we know about all of this, all of which was just them saying back to us the things we'd already told them about. And yeah, yeah, it seemed to be a lie. It seemed to just be they were trying to tell us what they thought they were trying to tell us what they thought we wanted to hear from them. They were just trying to say anything so that we would agree to be on the show.
Yeah, it definitely seemed that way. And I mean, Maxwell's first statement was on the show as soon as it started was, "We'll be exploring the world of the conspiracy theorist, and there were 4 suicide bombers, and it's unbelievable that people don't believe that, and I'm going to take them on a journey to change their minds." So just completely the opposite of what they told me.
Absolutely, and completely the opposite of what they told me.
What were some of those demands that you kind of wanted them to meet if you were going to be on the show?
I basically gave them 2 conditions. I wanted to be able to run my own camera, because obviously I wasn't going to trust their editing crew.
Yeah.
And also because, quite seriously, if someone can put me in a room with, you know, someone from who actually investigated this officially, I'd like to be able to sit there with a camera and talk to them about it. I'm not going to sort of start chucking accusations around or anything like that. I just, you know, I wanted to take this process seriously. If they were going to provide any kind of opportunity for me to actually advance this kind of investigation and this research, then, to be honest, I'd be a fool not to take it up. But I'd also be a fool to do it without permission to run my own camera and just to rely on them to provide me with the footage of it kind of thing. You know, that's not going to happen. So that was one condition. They never really gave me an answer on it. They just kind of jerked me around about that. The other condition was that we'd talk to people who actually had something to say. And they didn't seem to get anyone who actually had anything to say.
No.
Or anything of any significance. I said I wanted to talk to people either from the police, from the police investigation, the criminal investigation into 7-7, or from the ISC, who looked into MI5 and what they knew and what they were up to. And they didn't get anyone. I gave them a whole list of names, and they didn't get anyone.
Yeah, I think most of the guests they went to, or experts rather, I mean, none of them seemed to show any real grasp of the 7-7 case. They didn't even seem to have a basic understanding of the official story. One that sticks out to me was this supposed terrorism expert, I think it was Chris Hunter, who was just kind of rambling off the top of his head, saying random things like, oh, the bombs contain shrapnel and nuts and bolts to cause more damage, which has never even been claimed by the official story and certainly isn't backed up by any evidence.
I don't know where he's got that from.
Yeah. So what was your take on this Chris Hunter?
Well, I mean, it's ridiculous. The guy was sat there trying to persuade a bunch of people who, I mean, you say the talking heads didn't really know much about 7-7. Three of the participants didn't seem to know anything about 7-7.
Yeah.
And they were approaching this whole question of, were the bombs carried there in backpacks or something like that? Or were they somehow built into the train or strapped onto the train or whatever? And the bus, obviously, the train's in the bus. And they sort of butchered this argument by having Layla completely misrepresenting it and saying, oh, I think the people who were sat down were more badly injured than the people who were stood up, which isn't true as far as I know. The point is that there were far more injuries to the lower half of people's bodies, indicating very much a sort of explosion at floor level or possibly even coming up through the floor.
Mm.
It's got nothing to do with whether they were stood up or sat down. So she's presenting a kind of straw man argument to begin with. And then they introduce this terrorism expert to say, oh, no, nothing like that is the case. It's evident that these were explosions from inside the carriages and therefore suicide bombers. And to illustrate this, he holds up a picture from inside one of the carriages and says, look at this picture of the old gate carriage, and you can see that the explosion is largely going up and down.
Mm.
Well, firstly, what does that prove? And secondly, it wasn't the old gate carriage, it was the Piccadilly Line carriage. So this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't even know which carriage he's looking at. And none of the participants, as far as we know, pointed this out to him. Maybe they did, and obviously they just didn't show it. But, you know, it's just a stupid conversation. The whole thing was sort of mind-blowingly stupid.
Mm. And that particular photo that I think you're referring to, itself, it doesn't really show a good view of what the carriage looks like. I mean, all through 7-7, we've always had the odd photo, but nothing that you can really sink your teeth into and actually see where these holes were supposed to be. It never seems to come out.
No, you're right. We've had a handful of pictures. We got a few from Edgware Road and the Piccadilly Line one, internal photos. They were published by ABC, I think, several days after the bombings. They weren't published by the British media before then.
Yeah.
And there was a bit of a kind of falling out over this, or at least a pretend falling out over this. And we've seen a few external ones from the sort of Liverpool Street Oldgate one. And obviously we've seen quite a lot of pictures of the bus. But over time we've had the odd picture here, the odd picture there, but nothing that really provides any kind of proper record of this crime scene. And there must be lots of crime scene photos. There must be tons of them. There must be full versions of those little bits of video that they released at the inquests showing the insides of the carriages. But we've never seen them, so we can't really make much of an assessment from that evidence. And so we rely on those diagrams, the Metropolitan Police diagrams of what actually happened in those vehicles.
And of course, they're all completely contradictory with everything else, and, you know, just throws up more questions.
Yeah, yeah. You got into this in your rebuke of the conspiracy road trip. This whole question of, if we just sort of take these diagrams as a sequence of events, it doesn't make the slightest bit of sense. They've got Khan taking the most unimaginable journey after supposedly setting off this bomb. Mm. He sort of sets off a bomb that's several feet away from him, but supposedly is at his feet at the same time. And it propels him towards the explosion. I'm not sure if, you know, hydrogen peroxide and black pepper create some kind of temporal vortex, but short of that, I don't see how that they came up with this story. I mean, what are they trying to tell us here? His body ends up in a ludicrous position relative to where it's supposed to have started. Mm. And even that position in the diagram isn't where the crime scene examiner says that they found parts of his body.
No,
it's a mess.
It is. And on the show, there was also this sensationalist experiment of blowing up a London bus, which caused outrageous headlines in the Daily Mail. You know, how can they do this? And all that kind of thing. But, of course, there isn't really the proof of what explosives were used in the real attacks. So the experiment on the bus itself doesn't particularly make any sense. And you've also pointed out a few problems that you saw with it. Just go into this experiment.
Well, it was, like you say, it was sort of attention-grabbing. It was the big climactic explosive event at the end of the show that's kind of there to shock everyone and make anyone who at that point still had any doubts sort of go, ooh, bloody hell. In terms of proving anything about 7-7, I don't see how it can. They made absolutely no efforts whatsoever, it seems, to genuinely replicate what they were saying happened on 7-7. Because they had this guy, this bomb expert, this sort of eccentric old guy, who was quite amusing, building this bomb in kind of a biscuit tin or whatever. And he said he was making it out of concentrated hydrogen peroxide and black pepper. And he said his source for the notion that there was black pepper was some report of a policeman smelling pepper after the explosion at the scene of the bus explosion. And I don't know where he's got that from either. There has been this whole thing about black pepper or some variant thereof being mixed with peroxide up in this flat in Leeds. But the whole question is, what's the evidence connecting these guys to these tubs of whatever the hell this sludge was up in the flat in Leeds? What actually connects them to that? And the answer is basically nothing. What actually connects those tubs of sludge to the explosions down in London? The answer, again, is basically nothing. They didn't find any traces of that substance in London. So there's no connection there. They didn't find any fingerprints or DNA of these guys on these tubs up in Leeds. So, again, there's no real connection there. None of this is examined in the conspiracy road trip. No, they just blow up a bus. but the two fundamental problems were they were trying to answer the question, can homemade explosives blow up a bus? And, of course, the answer is yes. No, I don't know where they've got this question from. I don't know which of the participants really sort of brought this up and made an issue of it, but it's a non-issue. Of course you can. If you know what you're doing, you can blow up just about anything with homemade explosives. But these weren't homemade explosives. They were made by a bomb expert.
Right.
So how do they constitute the equivalent of, you know, four guys receiving instructions on the phone from Pakistan and mixing this up in a kitchen up in Leeds?
Yeah.
It's not equivalent. He puts the bomb in the wrong place on the bus. You would have thought they would at least put the bomb where they say Haseeb Hussain was sitting, but they don't. They put it on the wrong side and a bit further back. And when it blows up in the show, it creates quite a large hole in the floor. You know, lots of ripped metal, lots of problems with it, lots of distorted metal. Mm. And a large hole in the floor. And we see no such thing with a supposedly identical explosion on 7-7. There is no hole in the floor of the top deck of the bus. You can see it quite clearly in the photos.
Yeah.
So it's just not replicating the same event. So it proves, as far as I can see, proves nothing, but shocks everyone.
And I think it was actually Tony Topping that brought up debate on this. He was saying, well, there was evidence of military grade explosives, so, you know, I don't think they used homemade grade explosives. But of course, they could have explored the military explosive aspect of it, but of course he's fallen into the trap of thinking they gathered evidence of military explosives. Rather, it was more an opinion of several experts that military or high-grade C4 and things like that were probably what was used, but you know, there isn't actually the evidence either way, so the experiment itself is, you know, just theatre.
Yeah, it is, exactly. It is just theatre. There's a lot of stories suggesting that these weren't homemade explosives, but these were some kind of military-grade or high explosives. There were stories about, I think, the British police asking various quarrying companies and you know, military stockpiles and what have you around Europe to check their stockpiles, check their stock, and see if they had any explosives missing. That's a bit odd.
It was certainly a lead at the beginning there, and then it was quickly kind of changed. But they didn't explore any of that. They just went with, you know, it was pepper and sludge.
Yeah, yeah. And hence, in the Conspiracy Road Trip show, they just sort of... They were debunking, again, an argument that no one has ever seriously made. That's the thing. It's just a sort of half-baked story that someone who doesn't understand the case has kind of picked up and misunderstood, and then that's what they've chosen to knock down. It was just sort of exercise in futility, exercise in meaningless arguments about irrelevant things.
Mm. So what do you think the BBC and Renegade's role is? Are they just lazy and incompetent and have just rushed this program out there? I mean, they got the wrong photo of Mohammed Sadiq Khan. It seemed incredibly kind of flung together. Or do they perhaps deliberately have an agenda of quieting the debate and knocking down straw men to steer people away from actually looking into it?
I don't think they're just incompetent. No, I think the people making this program know exactly what they were doing, because in the communications that I had with them, and it seems that you had very similar communications with them until you kind of lost your rag and just told them to leave you alone. and fair enough. It seems that they were just nakedly deceiving or trying to deceive us. I think they never had any intention of making a serious program. I think they had an intention of making the exact same program that they made about 9/11, but about 7/7. And like in that show, you didn't really have, well, you maybe had one participant who actually sort of really had a clue about these discussions and these arguments and was arguing from some position of being informed and at least trying to be rational about it. But the rest of them were just kind of hodgepodge arguments that these people didn't really understand. And that's exactly the same that we got with this. You got one guy, John, who at least tried. I think he's mistaken about certain things, certainly the Peter Power thing. But on the whole, it seemed he was trying to at least ask some questions and trying to, you know, take this process seriously and make his point and say, this is where I've got my information from.
And by all accounts, he was heavily edited as well. A lot of what he said apparently was left out of the program.
Oh, I'm sure it was. You could tell that simply from the way it was cut, from what we actually saw. You could tell that these are just snippets of conversations that they've slapped together to create an overall impression. But the other three didn't seem to really know much about 7/7 and didn't seem to care very much about 7/7.
No.
You asked, is their role in just trying to dispel this stuff? No, I think it's not just about that. I think it's also about fudging the issue. I think it's about encouraging people down the path of, because they've refuted, well, because they've failed to properly refute an argument, for example, this whole thing about explosives in the trains and how injured people were, therefore that argument must still be true. Because the BBC are telling us this isn't true, but they're providing such a flimsy argument, we are therefore encouraged to think we, as in alternative-minded people, are more encouraged to think that these things are true. I think it's about, again, sort of bifurcating the thing, creating a dialectic, creating a polarized situation. Yeah. So you have a bunch of guys presenting a bunch of straw man arguments and you knock them down in really bad ways. It just encourages a really kind of stupid level of debate about the whole subject.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. I put my rebuttal of the show on YouTube, and generally there's been a positive response. I don't think any rational person who's took some time to inform themselves could look at the conspiracy road trip and conclude that it was anything other than a load of rubbish. You know, it did completely fail in the BBC's mandate to educate and inform. That's definitely for sure. So yeah, people agreed with my analysis mainly. I mean, there was a few disagreements with some of the fine detail, and that's fine. You know, we can't all agree on everything. But there's been this undercurrent of people that go beyond disagreeing with my video and are now insinuating that I'm a gatekeeper, that I've had an easy ride in the truth movement and need looking into. And there's all these thinly veiled accusations coming out now that I'm being dishonest with my videos. And it's all really for the simple fact that I disagree with some aspects of their theory about what exactly happened on 7/7. As if disagreeing with one theory somehow means I'm working for the government or being deliberately deceptive or something. I don't know exactly what happened. I don't think anybody can claim to know exactly what happened because so much data has been held back from us. That's just the nature of the intelligence agencies and the way this is done. But this kind of riff boils down to the old Peter Power mock terror drill meme that was first popularized by 7/7 Ripple Effect and has now really become, I guess you could call it 7/7's Building 7, if you like, the kind of point that everyone seems to go to when they're trying to broach the 7/7 subject. For example, a comment on my video just the other day, somebody wrote, "Care to mention the odds of Peter Power having a mock terror drill on the same day as the London bombings?" And I'm sure you've seen this, you know, everything online, every article, every video and documentary, there's always somebody that says, you know, "What about Peter Power and his training drill?" Well, I did address that in the video, and I think he probably knows that. I think he's just being antagonistic, whoever this commenter is. But just for the sake of clarification, I just thought I'd bring the Peter Power thing up again with you, Tom, because there are these insinuations floating around about both of us, and people still might not quite grasp where we're coming from. And just for the record, I mean, I've always maintained that Peter Power needs to be investigated in some way. I mean, if there's an inquiry, I would hope that Peter Power would be part of it. It does seem a bit odd to me that he could be privy enough to prepare the offices of a publishing company for a 7/7 style attack, but the country itself, for whatever reason, wasn't prepared or failed to act on those preparations. But I guess we should give this some context. Maybe you want to recap this, Tom. What was Peter Power's terrorism exercise? What does he claim it entailed? And what does the available evidence suggest that happened in his exercise?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. There is this insinuation floating around. I've been explicitly accused of working for MI5 by a whole bunch of people, which is nonsense. But, yeah, Peter Power was a former Metropolitan Police officer, counter-terrorism Metropolitan Police officer. He turned management consultant at some point in the 1990s after leaving Dorset Police under something of a cloud. It's not entirely sure what was going on there. He forms this company, Visor Consultants, a private management consultancy. On 7/7, he was running an exercise, as far as we know, for the publishing company Reed Elsevier. And he says in his original interviews, he didn't say who the company were, but he said he was doing it for a company of 1,000 people. That has got a bit kind of muddled up, and people have interpreted as meaning that it was some great big boots on the ground, suited and booted terrorism training exercise. But he's never actually said that. never explicitly said it. It's sort of a little bit implied in some of the things he says, but it's never something he actually explicitly said. This was the sort of exercise we were doing. So then when he went back on this in the Conspiracy Files show, and he says, no, this was just in a room with 6-8 people, a PowerPoint presentation, a sort of walkthrough exercise, this is the process that you should follow in case of this kind of incident. When he did that, people viewed it as him kind of backtracking, him kind of changing his story, trying to cover the thing up. And, okay, it is quite suspicious that he's running an exercise that doesn't exactly replicate what happens for real, or at least the official story says happens for real, but replicates certain elements of it very accurately. For example, it's taking place at almost the same time. The exercise, I think, began at 9 o'clock, and the bombings took place about 10 minutes earlier. The bombings on the tube trains took place about 10 minutes earlier. But that kind of begs the question, why would you start an exercise 10 minutes after an event when you're using that exercise as part of a kind of false flag situation? Anyway, it is suspicious. I can understand why people are suspicious of this. I can understand why people want to get Peter Power in a room and ask him some questions about, you know, who commissioned this, who chose the scenario, who chose the time and date, you know, name those people so we can go and ask them some questions as well. I get that. I'm not against that. What I am against, to be honest, is people taking those few minutes of media interviews and turning it into a whole theory of how 7/7 was carried out. I just think that's crazy.
Right.
I just don't think that evidence gives you enough to do that.
Yeah, the Ripple Effect documentary basically says Peter Power's exercise involved 1,000 people. It had physical elements to it, like you say, i.e. people running around London and in the underground. Muad'Dib suggests that the alleged bombers were duped in some way into taking part in that drill as actors playing fake terrorists in a drill that was happening on the ground in London. And this is still very much the mantra of many people. And because we don't agree with that, we become the gatekeepers. But what I think people need to remember is that it's just one theory based on, as you say, a few minutes of media interview. It is a conspiracy theory. It's not the truth. It's not proven by evidence. You know, Muad'Dib didn't stand trial because he was spreading the truth. Anyone sending material to a court would be charged for messing with a trial. It's just one theory, and there are many other possibilities out there, possibilities that have a lot more tangible evidence. For this to become the dogma of 7/7 truth, I think stifles people's ability to follow other avenues of research.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And it's not just the kind of the audience, the public, in the media consumers of the alternative media. It's also a lot of the spokespeople within it. Whenever people who don't really know that much about 7/7 but are maybe experts, or at least to some extent experts on 9/11 or some other similar associated event or similar associated issue, whenever they're asked their opinion about 7/7, the first thing they go to is Peter Power, because they know everyone's heard about it. But most of these people don't seem to have actually bothered to look into Peter Power in any detail, and actually, you know, gone through his statements and just said, you know, what has this guy said over time, and are there any fundamental contradictions here, or is it just as kind of something that's got, I'm not sure, mixed up in the discussion about this and in the endless replication of news items through the internet. And also, you know, is there something more important than this? Is there something for which we have a lot more evidence that actually provides a more kind of tenable and realistic hypothesis of what's going on here, of what's gone on with 7/7? And I think there is. I suppose we can get into that. The problem with the exercise theory, the problem with the ripple effect theory, or several problems with it, is that exercises have never been used in that way before. No one has ever, to my knowledge, used an exercise in a false flag attack in order to recruit the patsies.
No.
I've never come across an example of that. I've come across lots of examples of exercises being used for false flags or, you know, cover and deception things or whatever, some sort of deception warfare activity, some sort of operation. Lots and lots of examples of exercises being used, but none for that specific purpose. There's no real positive evidence that these guys did think they were taking part in an exercise. They didn't leave any notes that would indicate this. They didn't talk to anyone, have conversations with anyone that would indicate this. So,
well, there's nobody else from the supposed exercise that's even come forward. I mean, if there was 1,000 people or even 50 people, who are they? Where are they? You know, why haven't they made themselves known? You know, why does nobody else remember them? Why did nobody see anybody doing a drill that day?
So, we don't really have any positive evidence either in terms of historical precedent or in terms of specific evidence in this case that would tell us that that was what was actually going on. Whereas by contrast, if the hypothesis was something along the lines of these guys were duped to going to London by the security services, possibly by use of double agents, maybe one of the four alleged bombers actually was some sort of informer or spy or double agent, and that this was some sort of counter-terrorism intelligence operation that got these men to do these things, then we have lots of historical precedent from all over the place, you know, everywhere from the Victorian anarchists to the Northern Irish to, well, pretty much every radical movement or quasi-violent extreme movement that you can think of has been infiltrated and manipulated in this way. Lots and lots of historical precedent. We also have a fair bit of positive evidence in that, as we've relentlessly documented for at least the last 2 years, well, longer than 2 years, that these guys were surrounded by people who very much have the profile of intelligence assets or intelligence agents. So there's a lot more evidence on all of those people and on those connections and on what was going on for about 5 years before 7/7 that all adds up to a much more subtle picture, but a much better evidenced picture of what was really going on and why these men did the things that they did, in as much as they did actually do something, than just this kind of, oh, Peter Power was on television on 7/7 and he spoke for a couple of minutes and therefore that proves everything. Mm. You know, just the evidence stacks up in favour of one far more than it does in favour of the other. And so I find it quite rich of these people to accuse me and to accuse you and other people of being shills or being MI5 or whatever, when we're saying the evidence connecting these guys to MI5 is a lot stronger than the evidence connecting them to Peter Power. If we were working for MI5, why would we be saying these connections need to be looked at?
Right.
Why wouldn't we be going, look at Peter Power, because he's got nothing to do with MI5. That's what we'd be doing if we were shills, if we genuinely thought MI5 were involved.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a debunking show. We're not debunking the 7/7 truth movement. It's not like we've ever defended the official story. I mean, I don't think anyone else has systematically ripped to shreds the official story like you have, well, at least in documentary format, before. So if we're going to be accused of being gatekeepers, I just want people to see how me and you came to these conclusions. I mean, how can we be gatekeepers if what we're gatekeeping has no basis in the evidence? That would just make us rational, wouldn't it?
Exactly. If we, in as much as we're gatekeeping anything, we're gatekeeping rational and honest inquiry and investigating things properly. Well, you know, if that's what I stand for and if I'm excluding things that don't fall into that, so be it, to be honest. Because that's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in playing conspiracy theories. I'm interested in evidence, and I'm interested in lines of inquiry that actually go somewhere.
And just for the sake of covering all the points, because people will bring up some different things. What about the odds of Peter Powers' exercise, whether it was on the ground, which there's not really any evidence for, or in an office, which seems to be the most likely thing that took place? You know, Muad'Dib claims that there is a 3715590000000 to 1 chance of picking the same scenario as happened in real life. But what that excludes is, and what my question to him would be, well, what are the odds of the police exercise that happened a couple of days before 7/7, or the umpteen other drills and exercises that took place preparing for attacks on the underground? Surely that would make it more likely that Power would pick a similar scenario. He'd been on the Panorama program. You know, this was something floating around out there. It's logical that he would choose bombings on the underground as a scenario. Specifically, when you have a company that is near the underground and has employees that travel on the underground to get to work, presumably, you know, if there was some kind of an attack, they would need to, you know, account for where their employees are. Are they safe? You know, all this kind of thing. So to me, the odds game is extremely exaggerated. I know you've debated this point with Nick Collerstrom. So maybe you just want to throw in your two cents there about this whole odds debate.
Yeah, sure. Will do. The number that John Hill uses in his film, he seems to have lifted from the Alex Jones website. It's the same number, I'm pretty sure it is. And other numbers have been bandied about, and they're usually up in the billions. They usually seem to have been plucked almost out of nowhere. I mean, the calculations behind this assume several things. For example, they assume that there would only be one exercise in any given year, or in any given period of 5 years or whatever. And we just know that's not true. These things take place considerably more often than that. We don't know about every single exercise being run out there, so we can't be certain. But they're certainly a lot more frequent than just once a year. So the chances aren't 1 in 365 that they'd get the right day, because if you have 12 exercises once a month, then the chances go down to 1 in 30 that you'd get the right day. Or if they're once every couple of weeks, it goes down to, you know, 1 in 14. If you only include weekdays, it goes down to 1 in 10. So you've gone from a chance of 1 in 365 to a chance of 1 in 10 without really losing any logic or making any speculations. If anything, you're basing that number on a slightly more realistic and empirically backed up scenario. The chances of him getting the exact right stations, he does seem to have only got some of the right stations. There was nothing in his exercise, he's never mentioned anything in his exercise about Edgware Road. He's only talked about King's Cross, Russell Square and Liverpool Street as being stations that the exercise sort of predicted correctly. All of those stations are quite major and central London train stations. King's Cross and Liverpool Street are both sort of underground and overground stations at the same time, and therefore make much more sense as a terrorist target, and make much more sense, therefore, as a place to base an exercise around, than some of the more minor stations, or most of the more minor stations in London. So the chances of getting the right stations aren't sort of 1 in 243, and you do that three times or whatever. 273, I think there are stations in London, something like that. It's more like maybe 1 in 50 central London stations that you'd be likely to use in an exercise like this. So again, those odds come down considerably. It's still relatively unlikely, you know, it's still statistically unlikely enough to be worth going, something's not quite right there, there's probably some more to that story. But it's not so unlikely that it should sort of blind you with the science and blind you with the statistics of it all, so that then when they say, so this is what was really going on, you just believe it. But that's the technique that's being used there. It's just, look, this is an incredibly big number, be surprised. And then you sit there and you're surprised, and then they go, and now we're going to tell you the truth. It's kind of like a you know, shampoo commercial or something. it's silly. It's a really silly argument.
And again, we're not saying that Peter Power shouldn't be investigated a bit and this shouldn't be kind of ironed out. But just because his exercise is odd doesn't mean the rest of the ripple effect theory that the bombers were duped and ran off to Canary Wharf and there was an exercise physically on the ground and all these things, that doesn't then make that true.
No, of course it doesn't, because the two have nothing to do with one another. Just because something is statistically unlikely doesn't mean you can invent things about it. Mm. Whereas that is, in essence, what the ripple effect theory has done. And you've also got to remember, who made the ripple effect? A slightly odd guy, to say the least. A man who draws an awful lot of his worldview from the Star Wars movies. And therefore, we can probably assume this guy may have watched shows like Spooks, which happened to predict this whole, you know, exercise theory almost completely before 7-7 even happened. It's a bit odd, in fact, that when you go through the kind of fundamental parts of the ripple effect story, he concentrates on things like the Israeli warning, the warning from Scotland Yard to the Israeli embassy that then apparently went on to Netanyahu. He focuses on the exercise. He focuses on this rumor about people being shot at Canary Wharf. All of this stuff, all of these little memes, appeared in either episodes of Spooks or episodes of other TV shows that were similar before 7-7 even happened, with the one exception of the notion of explosions under the trains, which actually appears in an episode of Spooks after 7-7, but shortly before Ripple Effect came out. So I'm not saying he just kind of handpicked all this stuff from fictional TV shows. I'm just wondering whether, if you like, he's been a victim of predictive programming. And that's why he believes what he does.
It's definitely a possibility. He does seem to have kind of selected every rumor or anything that was a bit sexy, a bit rumory. He seems to have gathered them all and stitched them together.
And all, just like I say, just all have also were also sort of predicted in some way in television programs. I just find that odd that those were the particular details and the particular things he decided to pluck out of there.
What do you make of other branches of the theory? I think you briefly touched on it a few minutes ago, actually, but that the drill wasn't part of the real attack, in that the bombers were duped and all that kind of thing, but and I think this was this point was made on Conspiracy Road Trip, but it wasn't fleshed out enough to even really know what they were talking about. But the idea that the drill was running parallel in order to act as a cover to MI5 agents or Black Op teams that were carrying out an inside job, or was running parallel in a planning stage so people could say, well, what's going on here? And then people could go, well, no, this is just as planning for a drill. You know, what do you make of that branch of the theory?
I don't think that the exercise was physically involved with the attack. I don't think it was part of, to be honest, really, in any way. I understand what you're saying about the potential for using it as a cover and things. And this has been attempted before. This is what happened in the Ryazan incident in 1999. You remember there was all these bombings in Russian apartment buildings, and everyone suspects that it was they call themselves the FSB now, but the KGB. Mm. And in Ryazan, in one town where they found sort of barrels of explosives underneath this great big apartment building, and a couple of FSB agents were there sort of, you know, playing around with these explosives. And they said, oh, no, this is just an exercise. This is just a test. This is just some kind of, you know, simulation. And these are fake explosives. And the police who caught them kind of let them go because they said that. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility that you can use a drill in that way. I just think it's more likely that it's got more to do with cover and deception for our sake, to fool us rather than to fool people on the ground in London on the day. I think it was more about you know, this was a story for public consumption. The guy went on BBC, and then to make sure, in case people hadn't listened to his BBC radio interview, Peter Bauer then goes on ITV to tell everyone about this. He then goes on Canadian television a couple of times a couple of days later when he's in town for some disaster management consultancy conference. So he made sure that people knew about this. He made sure that people in America knew about this, or at least Canada, and by extension America. So I suspect if there is any connection, if there is a connection between the exercise and the attack, it's got more to do with psychological manipulation than it's got to do with physically delivering and carrying out the attacks. It's more about public perception than anything else.
Kind of diverting us off down a red herring as such.
Well, partly that, but also, if you like, partly trying to sort of convince us of our own prejudices to confirm our own biases for us. This whole exercise false flag thing has really taken on a life of its own, and now people are actively seeking out actively seeking out information about forthcoming exercises of all kinds, disaster management exercises of all kinds, whether you're talking the river's going to flood or whether you're talking there's going to be a chemical terrorist attack.
The Olympics and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And using this to try and map out forthcoming false flag events with absolutely no success whatsoever. And the Peter Power thing has very much fed into that, has fed into this notion that if we watch what they're doing all the time and we watch all of their exercises, then we'll know what's going to happen. Mm. And it doesn't work. It's never worked so far.
And it's not to say that on 9/11 exercises didn't play a role in perhaps diverting, you know, air defences or whatever. But after 9/11, when everyone's looking into exercises, then, as you say, they may have changed the narrative, and, you know, because people are looking at exercises, well, they're not going to do it that way again if there is this kind of false flag network going on or whatever.
Well, and this was always the point of exercises in military operations. If you look into the documents you get out of the war against Cuba in the early 1960s, the war against Castro, I know they didn't call it a war, but it basically was, you've got Operation Mongoose, you've got Northwoods, which was part of Operation Mongoose. They talk about using exercises to do things like they were suggesting we could put the Navy boats on patrol near the Cuban coastline and try and provoke Castro into, you know, launching a plane against us, and then use that as an excuse to flip the exercise live and actually invade. so the point of an exercise is always that there is a target audience. And I'm just wondering, in this case, is the target audience us?
Very interesting. Another point somebody brought up to me when debating this was, were the alleged bombers, you know, although the alleged bombers don't have any ties to Peter Power and this drill, perhaps they were still somehow working for the security services. They brought up Operation Crevice when Khan and Tanweer were surveilled. So broadly speaking, it does link them in a way to MI5. And this person made the case that because Khan and Tanweer weren't arrested during Crevice, that they were informants for MI5 and perhaps were the ones stitching up Omar Khayyam and everyone else. That's not really something I've ever thought about before. But going on what we know about Crevice and the detail that has come out, and as I explored in my film and you've explored, if anything, to me, it doesn't suggest they were informants, but like you said earlier, that they were influenced by informants. So, you know, what's your take on that?
On the whole, that's, yeah, I agree with that in terms of Operation Crevice, this big counterterrorism surveillance operation running, what was it, early 2003 to sort of March, April 2004. So the 2 years before 7/7. There are other people who turn up in the Crevice surveillance who didn't get arrested. at least one of the alleged 7-7 co-conspirators, the three men who were wrongly put on trial for some spurious connection to 7-7 that didn't really exist, at least one of them turned up in it as well, and I'm pretty sure they had his name, and I think they had his home address as well. So there are quite a bunch of people who weren't arrested when the hammer fell with Krevis and when they decided to sort of round up this bunch of people. They seem to have been stinging for, or at least, well, at least stinging, if not entrapping, for the previous year and a half. So that alone doesn't indicate that Khan and Tanweer were informants. There is an interesting little detail that the July 7th Truth Campaign pointed out to me, and that is one of the people who was arrested because of Krevis, Salahuddin Amin, was arrested in Pakistan, and he was held there for months. And according to him, he was very badly tortured, and this is why he ultimately confessed. He provided a confession to the Pakistani authorities, and then when he was flown back to Britain, he confessed to the British police that this was a real bomb plot. He says this is because he was sort of tortured. His mind was destroyed. He wasn't really in control of what he was doing. He was just saying whatever he thought he had to say to make it stop. And he was flown back from Pakistan in early 2005 on the exact same day that Khan and Tanweer flew back from Pakistan from their second visit. Well, from Khan's second visit there after he went in 2003 as well. So that alone doesn't really prove anything, but it is an odd little detail. They were in Pakistan with some of the Krevis suspects in 2003, at least according to Junaid Barbar, they were. And then they fly back from Pakistan in early 2005 on the same day as the sort of last Krevis suspect is extradited back to Britain. Maybe there is something to that, or maybe it is just a kind of bizarre coincidence.
I think the ISI need a bit more grilling in all of this. You had Omar Khayyam, didn't you, who kind of refused to carry on with the trial because the ISI were up to stuff back home with his relatives in Pakistan, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, he testified for a couple of days at the Krevis trial in early 2007. He, for 2 days, he basically says, yes, I went to Pakistan, I trained in these terrorism training camps, I was thinking of fighting in Kashmir. And then he starts talking about how these camps were being run by the ISI and being guarded by them, and how he's sort of related to people within the ISI. Then I think there's a break in the trial for a day over the weekend. And when he comes back the next morning, he says, I'm not going to carry on testifying. I'd like to clarify all of this, but I'm not going to carry on testifying because the ISI have had words with my family.
It seems like, very much seems like an international entrapment kind of case.
Well, look at Junaid Barbar. He was in Pakistan from shortly after 9/11. He first gets involved with Krevis in sort of mid-2003, so he's there in Pakistan for 18 months or so before he really gets involved in any of this. He was involved with Al-Muhajirun, which is, you know, the world's most infiltrated radical organization. Is there anyone in Al-Muhajirun who wasn't a spy? It's kind of the question we now have to ask. There was a story about that recently, wasn't there? A guy said he was a CIA spy within Al-Muhajirun in Luton. And of course, Luton being where Q lived. Q being the kind of overlord of this Krevis plot and a very probable MI5
spy. Yeah, he's another one that wasn't arrested, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he's suspicious as hell. But, yeah. And again, I do think if we jump to the conclusion that Khan and Tanweer were somehow working for the security services without being a bit more thorough about, you know, what was going on and when and what are the arguments for and against that particular hypothesis, it can be just as dangerous and just as kind of distracting as the Peter Power thing. I always think we should kind of be resistant to just jumping to conclusions.
Well, on the balance of probabilities then, which way do you sort of lean? Because we do have all this evidence that would suggest Khan and Tanweer were influenced or maybe groomed by informants and these dubious characters. If they carried out the attacks under those circumstances, having kind of been pushed that way, we still have to look towards the state for a level of criminal negligence or complicity, you know, lie hop, elements of my hop. But at the same time, as we've both explored, there isn't really any evidence that they did do it. The official account is completely full of contradictions. So is it just that the police did an appalling investigation and can't prove they did it, even if they did? Or is it that the backstory that suggests they were groomed by these informants and assets, is it that that's possibly a fabrication to incriminate them after the fact? Because they were set up in some way. You know, which kind of way do you lean on that?
My feeling about the police investigation after 7/7 is that they may well have been sort of sold a story. I think there's a long history of the British police kind of assuming that they know who's done something, and then without even necessarily sitting down and planning it that way, they just became fixated on this notion that these people were to blame. And this is particularly true when the British police investigate terrorist attacks, and just excluding other possibilities, and therefore not looking at the evidence objectively and not asking questions of their desired case hypothesis. From what I can see, there was a sort of groupthink going on within this police investigation from a very early stage. Exactly what caused that, I can't tell you. I don't think it was just incompetence, but at the same time, I don't think it was a kind of out-and-out conspiracy. I don't think these people who were actually crawling around these underground trains collecting evidence, I don't think they were somehow kind of in on some great big plot to deceive the British public. I think they themselves may well have been deceived, or at least have made some stupid assumptions that no one ever challenged. So I'm not sure what to make of the police investigation beyond that. In terms of this whole backstory, the pattern that I've found in my looking into it is basically that every single time there was a, quote, intelligence failure, unquote, it served the purpose of obscuring the connection between these four alleged bombers and these other men who are likely intelligence assets. This, therefore, had the consequence of meaning that the four alleged bombers were never arrested or interdicted in any way by the authorities. But it also meant that the intelligence assets kind of slipped away from the whole thing and didn't leave a massive trail of their connection to these men that we can now follow up and chase and try and find some of these guys and say, what the hell were you really up to? Whether all that's deliberate, well, I don't. Let's put it this way. I don't think it happened by accident. I don't think they just messed it up. I can't be certain that that's the kind of telltale sign of some kind of black op, some kind of covert op. But that pattern does suggest that. I can't deny it.
Well, there's another comment here I just want to run by you quickly before we move on. And it was from Andrew Johnson of Check the Evidence, the British guy who's a big proponent of Judy Wood's theories on 9/11. I thought it was a bit odd that he kind of popped up on my 7/7 video. But, I mean, I don't really know the detail of his work or the theories of Judy Woods or whatever. But yeah, on my 7/7 video, he said, so we just have to prove that the government account is wrong, but we don't need to determine what happened. Kind of in a sarky way. I would say, of course, we do need to determine what happened and who did it and so on. But I guess this goes back to the Peter Power stuff and whatnot. But surely the critiquing of alternative theories is part of that process. You know, for him to say...
Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah, for him to say that, you know, oh, you're just saying we just need to say the government account is wrong, but you don't want to look at who actually did it. I mean, we're just not going down that road that doesn't have the evidence there.
I'm interested in solving this case. But if I don't have the evidence to actually point the finger at someone specific, I'm not going to point the finger at them. Why on earth would I do that?
Mm.
That's a really silly thing to do, not just for legal reasons, but strategically as well. If you want to, you know, figure this thing out, if you genuinely want to try and solve this case, and I remain relatively optimistic that it's possible to do that, whether it'll happen, I'm slightly more pessimistic, but I do think it would be possible, then the last thing you want to do is get a reputation for going around pointing the finger at people wrongly, because that just means if you ever do get the key evidence, if you ever do get the smoking gun evidence that allows you to say, right, I've actually got a piece of the puzzle here that enables me to make a direct accusation against a specific person or group of people. If you've spent the previous 5 years, 10 years going around pointing the finger at anyone and everyone, then no one's going to take you seriously, even if you do get that, because, you know, it's the boy who cried wolf. You've got to be seen to be applying the same skepticism and the same standards of evidence and standards of logic to any hypothesis and every hypothesis that you're considering, and then just seeing which one of these comes out on top. I've got no objection to that process. I just think people should do it honestly.
Mm. And of course, his whole name is Check the Evidence, and his website is checktheevidence.com. So, you know, you'd think he'd understand where we're coming from. I don't know.
It's mystifying, a lot of this.
But having watched 7/7 Conspiracy Road Trip, particularly the ending there with Graham Folks, the father of a young lad who died in the alleged carriage with Mohammed Sadiq Khan, there is a definite line that has been drawn between survivors and victim family members and the, quote, conspiracy theorists. They don't seem to overlap. Graham Folks said that he doesn't think there's anything to the conspiracy theories. Survivors like Rachel North have actively clashed with conspiracy theorists online and on some of the BBC documentaries about 7/7. Yet, at the same time, when I was watching the end of the road trip, at the same time, what Graham Folks says does hint at a cover-up and proves the official story is dubious and incorrect. You know, he talks about the surveillance of Mohammed Sadiq Khan before the attacks. He's talked a lot about Junaid Babar, who was working for the FBI, and all these things we also talk about. And I can't help but feel that those that have taken a highly speculative, conspiracy-themed approach to 7/7, that stand by theories like ripple effect, you know, the people that happily call it an inside job without making a strong argument for that, have in a way alienated the very people we're supposedly trying to get justice for and who do actually question the official story. And I think the likes of the BBC have nurtured that divide with programmes like Conspiracy Road Trip by taking Muad'Dib, you know, putting his film on the BBC and debunking it and saying, look at these crazy conspiracy theorists. No victim, family member or survivor wants to be associated with a bunch of goofy conspiracy theorists. Do you see what I'm getting at? Have we been separated? I mean, I think you mentioned it a bit earlier, but separated into different camps that has almost prevented us from making a proper dialogue and pushing for things like an inquiry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have. And on the whole, the bereaved family members of the people killed have sort of been pushed into the official story camp over that, in as much as a certain hostility, if you like, does exist between at least some of them, and quite a lot of the people who, I suppose, we would find ourselves in the other camp with. But I don't really see myself as being in the same camp as the people behind Ripple Effect. I don't see myself in the same camp as Nick Colostrum and Tony Farrell. I don't think that we're doing the same thing. I don't think we're motivated by the same reasons. I don't really work with these people. I don't really have anything to do with them. By the same token, I have never sought to push my work at the bereaved because I don't want to intrude on their grief. And however much it might serve my cause, I wouldn't want to do that. I don't want to kind of latch on to some person who's lost a close relative or a friend or a girlfriend or something in a terrorist attack and then, even if I'm right, persuade them of the validity of my arguments so that they then become a kind of token for attracting attention to this thing. Mm-hmm. I know the BBC have no compunctions about sort of wheeling out survivors and getting who they already know what they're going to say and then getting them to say it. But I would have lots of compunctions about doing that. So yeah. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to try and do it. It's particularly strange what Graham Foulkes was saying because he has, you know, he's the one who actually said to The Guardian that the whole Junaid Barbar thing suggests that the US intelligence services were complicit in this in some way. So for him to then turn around and say that there's nothing in the conspiracy theories, I think he's probably speaking from his heart there more than his head. For him and for the rest of them, it must be very hard to persist with these sorts of questions, particularly when you've been kind of messed around so much and been told so many different things over several years, and every attempt that you've made to actually get some proper answers has been frustrated and been delayed. Sooner or later, you are just going to want to put the thing to rest and, you know, kind of not have to think about it anymore, not really want to talk about it much anymore. And so he's probably more expressing that than anything else. That does put us in a rather awkward position. But like I say, I'm not kind of connecting my work really with the bereaved because I don't really feel that I have a role or have any right to go and hassle them in any way. So I think we can continue with what we're doing. Just we should be wary of doing it in a sensitive way because there is that division. And if we're ever going to reach across that division, it's going to be intelligent, sensitive people who manage it rather than, you know, aggressive, confrontational people who think they're Jesus.
Yeah. I don't think people like Muad'Dib and David Shaler and Tony Farrell and Nick Colostrum at times, they don't do themselves any favours. I mean, they can do what they want. I'm not the 7-7 thought police, but you have to question somebody who positions themselves as sort of an alternative leading expert on 7-7, but then says he's God and calls himself Muad'Dib and says he's something like the rightful king of Israel or something like that. Or then you look at Tony Farrell, a very smart man. He must have some academic background. He was an intelligence analyst, as we're continually told. For him to then come out and use all these buzzwords like satanic New World Order and to talk about Jesus speaking to him in dreams and how his priest told him to look into 7-7. And then he does
speak. How there was curious things going on with some pub that was being renovated near his house while all of this was going on, or whatever it was.
Yeah, bringing up Freemasons and
Dragging all this into it.
I mean, what are they doing? Are they working towards a reinvestigation, an inquiry, trying to get justice? Or are they just off enjoying the sort of conspiracy theory limelight and stroking their own egos? They can do what they want, but they're not doing themselves and 7-7 Truth any favours by handing these sort of things on a plate to the mainstream media to go, these people are crazy, don't go over there. It's all very strange to me.
I don't know really what motivates them. I've never heard any of them speak with any degree of passion or any degree of, it seems to me, sincerity about simply the need for truth and justice, which is surely what this boils down to. Because if that suspicion that the state was behind this, or some other private group possibly was behind this, and that they set up these four men to appear to be the culprits, then we're not just looking at a case of false flag terrorism, we're also looking at a massive conspiracy to pervert the course of justice and a massive miscarriage of justice. So that's what we're actually trying to approach here. That's what we're actually potentially dealing with and probably dealing with. So I don't see how, like you say, using buzzwords and just sort of trying to connect the dots to anything and everything. I mean, how can you ever investigate like that? Is that what a serious investigator does? Is that, in fact, what a serious intelligence analyst does? Or is that the behavior of someone who, oh, I don't know. Maybe it is about the limelight. Maybe it is about the fact that if you go, look, it's them, they did it, you gain a lot more attention than if you go, this needs to be investigated. Because if you say this needs to be investigated, people think, oh, well, bugger, that means I've got to investigate it. Whereas if you go, it's them, they did it, people go, oh, right, it was them. They don't have to do any more. It's providing people with the simplest, most kind of tabloid response to the whole 7-7 question. And therefore, it's kind of taking the path of least resistance. It's the easiest thing to do within the truth movement. It's much harder to actually carry out a sincere investigation.
And they all seem to fit the same mold, this conspiracy theorist, I have something special to say, something special has happened to me, whether it's a dream about Jesus or that I'm God or... It just seems like a pattern that we've seen time and time again within the alternative media, and these types of people who follow this pattern always seem to be the types of people that get the most airtime, the most kind of promotion within the alternative media community. It's like they press all the right buttons and they get to where, you know, everyone knows who they are. And it just seems odd to me. I mean, Tony Farrell, you know, he's now lauded as the principal intelligence analyst that came out and said all this stuff about 7-7. He's somebody to have on our side. But he's not brought anything new to the table. He's just reiterated some of the documentaries that he's watched online. He's not somebody he's not a whistleblower. He doesn't have anything extra to say. He doesn't bring forth any new evidence. He's just parroting the same old conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I mean, he's telling the truth community or whatever what they want to hear, just as those guys from Renegade Productions or Renegade Pictures or whoever were telling us what they thought we wanted to hear. Farrell's telling Alex Jones what Alex Jones wants to hear, and so therefore Alex Jones is going to be happy to have him on his show. But is anyone really learning anything from any of this? Are we actually furthering any particular aim that we have with any of this? No, I don't really think we are. I think the only things that you can really do is try and sort of investigate the hell out of the thing yourself, if you have the time and if you have the patience to, or at least investigate parts of it and try and contribute that to the overall. And try and draw people's attention to it. Aside from doing that, and when I say draw people's attention to it, I mean in a rational way, in a reasonable way, in a way that will actually make people sort of go away feeling inquisitive rather than go away feeling that they've been bombarded with theories from some crackpot. Aside from doing that, I think pretty much everything else regarding the 7-7 issue is a waste of time, if not an active distraction.
Well, just before we move on perhaps to this latest entrapment story involving the New York Federal Reserve and whatnot, you're writing a book on 7-7, I believe. What can people expect from that book? Are you focusing on one aspect of 7-7, or pretty much everything you've researched into one kind of encyclopedia of information? What's your approach to the book?
It's not really a kind of encyclopedia. I think if people are looking for that, it already exists in the form of the July 7th Truth Campaign and in the form of our several hours of documentaries that we put together on this. If people want to learn about 7-7 and just kind of start from almost a blank slate, that's the best places they can go. Those are the best places they can go, rather. In the book, basically it starts out by looking at all of these problems with 7-7 in terms of the media coverage of the day itself. And if you like, trying to show how I don't think that we can really resolve it by using that method, by, you know, going through all of these newspaper websites and trying to pick out a quote here and a line there that might be able to be woven together into an explanation. So then I look at sort of the wider media picture of the discussion about 7-7 in terms of both the mainstream and the alternative, and how that has, to my mind, largely failed at accomplishing what it's supposedly trying to do. I certainly devote quite a bit of time to the CCTV evidence and the kinds of theories and arguments that have come out of that, which ones I think go somewhere, which ones don't. That's kind of the first section of the book, which is largely about just 7-7 itself and media coverage. The second big section of the book is all about the intelligence background, because that's, to my mind, where the strongest evidence lies and where the investigation should focus and where you actually get some answers, or at least you get some evidence on which you can try and build some answers. So I go through the whole of the ICRA bookshop scenario and what was going on up in Leeds, then what was happening with Crevice, and also look at some of the parallels between the kind of what the intelligence community were up to before 7-7 in the context of them lying about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or the non-existent weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Because that's, you know, that's the other big thing that was going on in British intelligence in that period between 9/11 and 7-7. Aside from these counter-terrorism operations, what else were British intelligence up to? They were up to fabricating a load of evidence to support a war. So even more reason to say, why the hell should we believe a word they say about this? And then the final section gets into the whole question of predictive programming and returns to this issue of a polarized discussion where you're forced into sort of one of two opposing camps, either within the truth movement or taking the truth movement as one camp and pretty much everyone else, the mainstream public, as the other camp. And, yeah, go through my reasons for why I think the Peter Power exercise is much better understood as part of a, I suppose, psychological operation than it is as part of a physical carrying out of a false flag attack. And then in conclusion, I basically just say where I think the investigation needs to focus and what kind of evidence should still exist that could give us some answers to this.
Well, I'll definitely be looking out for that. I mean, I've yet to find a good book on 7-7, really. As you say, the July 7th Truth Campaign is really where all the meat of the information in an encyclopedia form is really kept. I did like Nafis Ahmed's original book on 7-7, but a lot has came out since that book, which I think, you know, needs a bit updating. So yeah, I'll definitely be looking out for that. Something else that has taken place since we last spoke is this New York Federal Reserve bomb plot or sting operation or entrapment operation, depending on how you look at it, where this young man from Bangladesh, Kwasi Nafis, I'm not going to say his whole name because I'll completely butcher it, but he hadn't been in the US for even a year, but somehow wound up being provided a fake bomb from the FBI and was accompanied by an undercover policeman to allegedly set off this fake device. Obviously, the evidence isn't really forthcoming yet. All we have is this federal complaint. So there's no telling exactly how much provocateuring went on or what evidence supports the prosecution. But, you know, they'll always maintain that he made up all the decisions himself. And, we just kind of followed him and gave him a hand when he asked for it. But broadly speaking, yeah, what is your take on this latest sting operation by the FBI?
Well, I think you pointed out an interesting argument, an interesting aspect of this in your article on your website about it, in that the story that we have about this guy so far only really starts when he arrives in America. We don't really seem to know much about where was he before that and what was he up to before that. But nonetheless, throughout his whole time in America, at least from what we can glean from the reporting on this so far, almost everything that he did that led up to this point where he's supposedly trying to set off this bomb to blow up the New York Federal Reserve, almost everything he did, he's doing in contact with some kind of undercover policeman or FBI informant or FBI agent or someone else who's, you know, directly connected to the security services. It's not like, I find it bizarre that they can make that argument, and it will be interesting to see what happens when this one goes to court. But it's strange that they try and make the argument that we were just kind of following him along, and he was always had this intention, and we just sort of helped him when he asked us to. Because if at every point he tried to do something, he was only able to sort of do it because of someone working for the security services, then this guy didn't pose a threat.
Mm.
This guy isn't, you know, whatever idea he might have in his head, he's not a threat if he doesn't have any kind of contact or capacity to carry out such an idea. So that's what it should boil down to. And I hope in the trial he is found innocent, because that's what this story sounds like. It sounds like they just found some not very bright young man with some crazy ideas and you know, gave him a fake bomb and told him what to do with it. I hope he's found innocent, but I don't have any great faith in the American public, whoever is selected for that jury, that they'll do so. I certainly don't see that he's guilty.
And I mean, what I find to be an issue is the original kind of, the story starts, like you say, oh, this guy was extreme. He was looking to start a cell of terrorists, and somehow one of our informants got wind of this and pretended he wanted to join this cell. But they're not clear about when they first met, how they first met, where this guy was when he was supposedly making these extremist remarks to recruit a cell. Was he involved in any mosques? Which mosques were they? Who else was surrounding him? How was he radicalized? Nobody really knows. It just starts kind of midway. So I'd be interested to know how exactly this informant did get in contact with this alleged bomb plotter. Because also, actually, the informant is not an undercover FBI agent. He's an informant that was arrested for some other charge and flipped and began working as an informant. So we also have to understand, who is this person? What is he willing to do and say and make up, you know, about the alleged bomber?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about any kind of any kind of informant situation, is that it can flip into a agent provocateur situation without necessarily the agency handling the person wanting them to do that and telling them to do that. I mean, they will always want them to do that, because that means that they've got more chance at prosecuting someone, but they won't necessarily have given the informant orders to do that. It's just kind of, if you like, tacitly understood that the more flagrant a thing you can get someone to do, and that we can ultimately prosecute them for, the better it is for the informant who's trying to get these charges out from over his head and presumably maybe come out with this with some money. He's always likely to get a better deal from the authorities if he manages to hook someone really well. and therefore it's always in the informant's interest to provoke a bit. And that's there regardless of whether there's any explicit intention by the FBI or not. So you can imagine when there is an explicit attempt by the FBI, it's actually rather easy for them to do this, because they've already got informants in desperate situations who will be willing to do these kinds of things. It's something we don't get in this country. It's something that doesn't really work the same way, because pretty much all informants and all undercover policemen and all intelligence agents and assets of pretty much every stripe in the UK, their names are kept secret. They never get up in court. That's why in Crevis you don't have Q, it seems, up in court. You don't have any sort of British witness against these people in any major way. It's why we got Junaid Barbar, a Pakistani-American. It's because the Americans can say, oh yes, this guy was he's an FBI cooperator now. Whereas in Britain, they don't like doing that. They don't like admitting that they've made deals. In fact, you're not even supposed to make these kinds of plea bargain deals with cooperators, let alone are you supposed to have lots of undercover informants and agents and provocateurs running around. I mean, they do. They just kind of pretend that they don't. So you don't get the same kind of terrorism trial in the UK as you get in the US. That's partly why we see so many more of these sorts of cases coming out from the US, is because when it happens in this country, it doesn't really in any way get admitted that there was an undercover agent.
Mm. And you mentioned earlier about 7-7 that going through the media and kind of stitching together a story is probably not the best way to do it. And already we've seen the media spin this particular story for their own agendas. The Daily Mail's headline today is, Federal Reserve bomber is one of most dangerous terror suspects in US since 9/11. Apart from the fact that it wasn't him that acquired the bomb, it was the FBI, and he wasn't actually in contact with any real Al-Qaeda members, only fake FBI Al-Qaeda members, whether you can even call the real Al-Qaeda a real Al-Qaeda. But, so how that equates to being the most dangerous potential terrorist since 9/11, I've got no idea. And there's also this claim that's been floating around that he wanted to target Obama for assassination, which is, as far as I can tell, completely fabricated. I may have missed it, but nowhere in the federal complaint does it say that he wanted to go after the president specifically. I think there was something about perhaps going after high-ranking officials or something. But it's all over the media that he wanted to kill Obama. And obviously this is during election season, and Obama's the guy that killed bin Laden. So there's that whole agenda at play as well in the media. It just seems they will spin it whatever way they want to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly they're going to use it in that way. This whole, you know, kill the king, kill Obama meme has been knocking around for quite some time. In fact, I think it was knocking around even before he got, well, I say elected, but you know what I mean. in the first place, there was this notion that, you know, there are people out there who want to assassinate Obama. I haven't really come across any great example of anyone who's got any serious plan to do it. It just seems to be one of those things that the media likes to report on. And I suppose once they've started reporting on it, they just carry on with the same meme. They just keep churning it out there. But no, there doesn't seem to be anything in this guy. It'll probably boil down to some conversation he had with some FBI agent or undercover person or whatever, talking about potentially assassinating people, and then someone would have said Obama's name, and that's all it will be. Mm. It's you know, it'll be that level of evidence. It'll be that level of a assassination plot. Because that's what it pretty much always boils down to in these cases, is, you know, some idle jihad chat.
And they've also tried to link this in with the Anwar al-Awlaki branch, or supposed branch, of al-Qaeda. The only real link that they're putting forward that ties him to al-Qaeda in any way at all is through a conversation he had en route to the Federal Reserve with the undercover law enforcement guy. And he was alleged to have said, oh, I'm inspired by Anwar al-Awlaki. And so that's the evidence that he's tied to al-Qaeda. And he supposedly had a copy of the Al-Qaeda magazine Inspire, which I think you'll agree itself is a very suspicious publication. But they seem to be trying to tie a lot of these entrapment sting operations to this Al-Awlaki group who supposedly wrote this magazine. And, you know, maybe you want to go into that a bit.
Well, yeah, they do. And Al-Awlaki came around, he sort of appeared almost out of nowhere. Kind of when they stopped talking about bin Laden. They stopped talking about bin Laden a few years before they then decided to start talking about him again and said that they'd killed him. And Awlaki was one of the people who sort of they seem to have used as a kind of make weight, a sort of interim, caretaker manager of Al-Qaeda. Whether or not that the man actually ever did anything of any significance doesn't seem to be clear, and then they killed him with a drone, so he certainly met a rather grisly end. They like tying it in with these things, I think, because it makes it easier for people to believe it. People like the idea that, you know, these the reasons why, in particular with ideological terrorists, which is what we're told the Islamic terrorists are, that they're part of something bigger, that they are somehow influenced by these specific radical figures, rather than, of course, the idea that these are just some sort of people who've kind of been spat out by the Islamic militant movement in some way and have found themselves in the middle of a sting operation, which is usually what they are. I think people accept it more if they think, oh, he was influenced by that radical guy who we've been told about, that preacher on the internet with his YouTube videos. Oh, that's why he did what he did. And it stops them from asking the question, did he do what he did because he was surrounded by people working for the security services, which is the much more important question. It's kind of a cover story for all of that, a sort of background myth for what was actually a kind of covert op from start to finish.
And it seems Awlaki himself may have been an asset in some form. Reports that he was invited to the Pentagon after 9/11 as some kind of outreach to the Muslim community. There's no real telling what exactly went down in that meeting, but it seems odd that this guy, that there would be this link between this guy and the Pentagon or whatever. And then after that, he's the new kind of leader in Al-Qaeda.
Well, and the other thing that I've always found odd about that whole Awlaki going to the Pentagon thing was I don't remember any kind of Muslim outreach program after 9/11. I certainly don't remember the Pentagon being very interested in Muslim outreach programs immediately after 9/11. I remember them shouting very loudly, we need to go and bomb the bloody Muslims.
Yeah.
pretty much to a man, that was all they were interested in. That was all they would talk about. So this notion that he was there as part of a Muslim outreach program sounds very dubious to me. I don't remember anything like that. That doesn't sound realistic at all to me.
And what do you make of the Inspire magazine, which supposedly comes from his group? And for those that don't know, Awlaki supposedly headed Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a group out of Yemen, which is being drone-striked at the minute. And there's this magazine that is touted as the radicalization magazine that everyone reads and turns into a terrorist. And what's your take on the magazine? Because it's English-speaking, it's written in English, it's a tabloid kind of style. There's articles, you know, make a bomb in kitchen with your mom. And just, you know, it's just odd. You know, if you're a hardcore fundamentalist Muslim, why are you making tabloid kind of English-speaking magazines? Wouldn't you be sitting there kind of reading religious texts and things? I don't know. But
well, or if you were going to put together a magazine, would you not write it in Arabic? since that's the most widely spoken language among Muslims, I think. I'm pretty sure it must be. It doesn't make a lot of sense, this Inspire magazine. So again, you wonder, is there this element of theatre to all of this that you mentioned earlier? And again, what's the sort of question that keeps coming up in this conversation is, who is the audience for this? It's written in English, so presumably its audience is English speaking. It's written according to kind of, like you say, sort of tabloid friendly, Western media friendly way, that means that they can kind of grab little snippets out of it to report on. So you do wonder, is that, you know, the whole purpose of this entire publication? Didn't seem to last very long. Is it still being published?
From what I can see, all the whenever it crops up as being involved in any of these cases, it's always the first or, you know, second couple of copies of it. It doesn't seem to have carried on. Yeah, just a couple of PDFs that basically came out of nowhere online through various forums and stuff, and with no other verification, really. It's touted as the official Al-Qaeda magazine, but there's no real proof that it's tied to anyone in Al-Qaeda. It's just something floating around the internet. And there was some worry when it was first released that it contained a virus, and some of the extremist Muslim forums were saying, you know, that, you know, they didn't even know if it was authentic. People were worried that they were going to get a virus when they downloaded it, because there was some, it was messed up. Kind of the display of it was all scrambled, and people wonder whether it was kind of infiltrated by the security service, intelligence agencies, and messed with a bit. Just all sorts of weird things. But the point is, it's never really been verified in any way. It just floats around out there.
Yeah, and it's become a kind of icon or focal point. It's one of those things that, particularly in the sort of post Bin Laden world, where we've kind of gone beyond Al Qaeda, at least to some extent, or so we're told, it is one of those things that just sort of keeps coming up time and time again. Oh, it's that dastardly magazine again that's inspiring all these Muslims to get entrapped by the FBI. So you do wonder, is it part of the provocation? Is it, in effect, an agent provocateur in PDF format?
And I got a quote in my article from, I can't quite remember who it is, some kind of Norwegian, I think it was Norwegian, expert on terrorism or whatever, and he says, well, look, this kind of material has been floating around for years. There's much more detailed and important pamphlets and terrorism training manuals and things that are out there, but this is the one that gets picked up in the media because it is so sensationalist.
And I think he's dead right. There are much more, if you like, effective training manuals for the would-be terrorist out there, including the Encyclopedia of the Afghan Jihad, which you can find online. It's not that difficult to find. It is in Arabic, so obviously I've got no idea really what it says. But that is a sort of well-known and relatively widely available manual that contains lots and lots of bomb recipes and all kinds of, if you like, practical information for people who might want to be terrorists. There's also the so-called Al-Qaeda training manual, which was written by a triple agent, Ali Mohammed. And it seems that he wrote it based on the same US Army training manuals and CIA terrorism training manuals that were being used in the School of the Americas for, you know, training people involved in Nicaragua and all of that sort of thing. It seems that he wrote, if you like, a sort of Muslim equivalent of those manuals. Why he did that? Well, we can only guess. But anyway, the point is, you can get much, much better material out there. It's not difficult to find. The Al-Qaeda training manual you can actually find on the Justice Department website. So, yeah, the fact that this silly magazine gets all this attention, it does seem to be like, again, who's the audience for this? Is the audience the Western media? Is this something being put out there not just to sort of encourage the odd, naive young Muslim into doing something that gets him in a load of trouble, but also to give the Western media something to talk about? Because let's face it, there hasn't been a major Islamic terrorist attack in the West since, well, I can't remember, since Madrid 2004, that's 8 years ago, 8.5 years ago now. That's quite a long time. I can't think of one. I mean, I don't believe 7-7 was one. So, I mean, what else has there been?
Yeah, the rest of them have just been this style of sting operation that often seems to be entrapment or, you know, in the case of the underpants bomber, maybe even more than that. So, yeah, there's not for this army of terrorists that are waging war against the United States with cells everywhere, they're doing a pretty rubbish job at
doing
any kind
of
attack.
Their batting average is not high.
Like, if you're a terrorist, you could just wake up tomorrow and go to the shops and, you know, blow it up. I mean...
Yeah, it's not even that hard to carry out a bombing or carry out a shooting. It certainly isn't hard to carry out a shooting in America. So there clearly aren't hordes of wild-eyed Muslims out there wanting to destroy the West through terrorism. So I can only assume that's why they have to resort to all of these sting operations and things. And it's been going on for a long time. This sort of thing has, I think what we're seeing is just sort of the most streamlined and up-to-date version of it. They will presumably get better at it as time goes on if we keep letting them. And with the whole kind of terrorism threat being gradually widened, and now they're starting to talk about Occupy and the anarchists and the Ron Paul supporters and any kind of, certainly the sort of white nationalists in America, they're back on the terrorism agenda. Now there's a Democrat in the White House. All of this sort of thing just hints at, you know, a sort of total suspicion of everyone as a potential terrorist. And so if they are getting better at these sting operations, they're getting sort of even closer and closer to people like us. So you've got to be aware of these things. You've got to be aware that people you don't know who might try and incite you to do something could have distinct ulterior motives for doing that.
And I do find it particularly interesting that the target this time was the New York Federal Reserve building. The only people I've ever heard rail against the Federal Reserve are the kind of Ron Paul supporter crowd. And in some American government kind of literature, there's the Mayak report and so on, Ron Paul supporters are designated as potential domestic terrorists. So you can foresee a time, sometime in the future, where, you know, these kind of shock jock reporters on, you know, the US news might start equating Ron Paul to Al-Qaeda and things like that, because they were targeting the Federal Reserve as well. You know, there's all these things that, you know, these connections that seem to be happening these days.
Yeah, and I would take issue. I don't think it's just Ron Paul supporters who bang on about the Federal Reserve. I think some of the Occupy movement seem to have twigged that the Federal Reserve is quite important to all of this. But I take what you're saying in broad terms, certainly. And I'm just wondering. I mean, has anyone ever tried to bomb the Federal Reserve before? The only examples I can think of were in Die Hard with a Vengeance. Diren Barot, who was another victim of a probable sting operation in 2004, he was talking about potentially bombing the headquarters of the IMF and the World Bank and other sort of New York banks. I'm not sure if he ever specifically talked about the Federal Reserve, but it's the same kind of thing. So maybe what we're seeing in this is just a sort of echo of what happened with Diren Barot and, you know, previously with non-Muslim equivalents.
Well, we've gone a good hour and 40 minutes now. Is there anything else you want to add to this story?
No, not particularly. I mean, I did write a review of the Conspiracy Road Trip. If people want to read that, if they haven't already, it's the most recent update on my website, investigatingtheterror.com. Aside from that, I hope you enjoyed listening to all of this, and that I hope you've found it an interesting conversation.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Tom. I look forward to the book when it's finally out, and I'm sure I'll have you on again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Keelan. It's been a pleasure talking to you too.
Flipping the Pyramid.
That about wraps everything up for this week, folks. Be sure to check out the Strange Bedfellows project on wideshut.co.uk and make a pledge on the Indiegogo page, the donation system that I'm using. Also, be sure to check out Tom Secker's website, investigatingtheterror.com. But from me, Keelan Balderson, catch you next week on the Wide Shut webcast.
If you found the preceding information valuable, please consider buying a DVD or making a small donation of your choosing. Go to wideshut.co.uk/donate. That's wideshut.co.uk/donate. You are the resistance.